Well, brethren, as we prepare for the Passover, I'd like to look at some of the events that lead up to the crucifixion of our Lord and our Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, from Revelation chapter 13 and verse 8, we know that Jesus Christ was slain from the foundation of the world. God determined well beforehand that Christ would die for the sins of the world. And that's pointed out to us in John chapter 1 and verse 29. But prior to Jesus Christ's death, he was subjected to a great deal of injustice and yet without sin. You know, if I asked for a show of hands, I'm sure that every one of us could raise our hand that we have been a victim of injustice from some point in time in our life. Throughout our life, we run into situations to where we are treated unfairly, or we have a loved one that's treated very unfairly. Well, prior to Jesus Christ's crucifixion, he was treated very unfairly, and yet he did not react in a sinful manner. Now, all I can say is the times that I can recall upon when I was treated and I felt unjustly, I did not always react in a converted manner. Oftentimes, carnal nature will get the best of us when we feel that we are treated unjustly or unfairly. But notice what the Apostle Paul said in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15. Jesus Christ, in him suffering the injustice that he suffered prior to his crucifixion, left us a beautiful example that we can follow the next time we find ourselves in an unjust situation. Paul writes here in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, he says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may be able to obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." So one of the things that we can reflect upon is the next time that we find ourselves feeling like we are being treated unjustly, that we can go before the throne of our high priest, who suffered a great deal of injustice before he was finally put to death, and he knows exactly what we are going through. He knows exactly the type of emotions that we are feeling as we go through a very difficult time or a very difficult trial in our life. Now, each of us have experienced injustice in our lives. We often find ourselves faced with a particular situation, and we will say, "That's not fair." How many times have we said that in our life? Many times. You know, as children, we used to say it all the time, didn't we? "That's not fair." And as a child, what would we do? We would typically react in a very carnal manner. Well, guess what? As we grow up, as we mature, we still find ourselves faced with situations all the time, and at least internally, if not verbally, express the idea of, "That's not fair." And certainly in terms of our attitudes and sometimes in our actions, we react in a very carnal manner when we find ourselves faced with such a situation. We live in a world today that perpetuates and receives a great deal of injustice. All you have to do is look out at the world and follow current events, and you realize that this world is filled with injustice. People not being treated fairly. Typically a reaction that perhaps we don't always see firsthand is the fact that in terms of the United States and in terms of our foreign aid, we give a great deal of foreign aid to the nation of Israel. And quite frankly, I think rightly so, because had we not given them that aid, they would have ceased to exist somewhere along the way. But you know, if you're a Palestinian and you feel like you're under the thumb of the Israelis and you see us giving billions of dollars to the Israelis and, you know, a small pittance to them, what would you say? "That's not fair." And of course, their reaction oftentimes toward the United States and U.S. citizens is one of hatred, because they feel that we are not treating them fairly in their conflict with the Israelis. And of course, now, this year, we're in an election year. And oftentimes, the results of elections don't go the way that people think they should have gone. And oftentimes, what is the reaction when that occurs? That's not fair. Each of us, no doubt, have experienced a great deal of injustice in our lives. Sometimes we're not treated fairly because of our beliefs and because of the church that we are a member of. Many of you have had to face persecution because you would not work on the Sabbath or you would not work on one of God's holy days. And during those times, oftentimes you were not treated fairly, not treated the way that you should have been. And undoubtedly you feel, as I have in the past, well, that's not fair. I'm not being treated as I should be. I'm not being afforded the rights that I deserve. Around 600 B.C., the prophet Habakkuk prophesied concerning the destruction of Judah and prophesied the Babylonian captivity. Notice Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk chapter 1. And we'll begin here in verse 1. From the opening verses, we see the reasons for the destruction of the nation of Judah. Habakkuk chapter 1 and beginning in verse 1. The burden or the oracle which the prophet Habakkuk saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me, and there is strife, and contention arises. And therefore the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, and therefore perverse judgment proceeds. And of course, as you reflect upon these verses that we just read here in Habakkuk, and you look at the general situation of our nation today, you see a certain parallel. You see that justice oftentimes is not afforded to the people who should receive that justice. So prior to the Babylonian captivity, the wicked were in the majority, and the righteous were a minority of the land. Their society was disintegrating because people had rejected and perverted the law and justice. And therefore, God punished the kingdom of Judah with the Babylonian invasion and captivity. Now, you know the story. The Babylonian captivity or the Babylonian invasion actually went in stages, and eventually the city of Jerusalem was destroyed around 586, 585 B.C. The Jews were in captivity for 70 years, and then after 70 years, they were allowed to come back and resettle in the land. And upon returning to Jerusalem, the Jews rebuilt the temple, and it was dedicated on March the 12th of 515 B.C. And we see this in Ezra chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6. And let's notice what we read here in beginning in verse 15. Ezra chapter 6, beginning in verse 15. So the Jews were allowed to return to Jerusalem. They were allowed to rebuild the city. And they rebuilt the temple, and it was dedicated here on March, what we would term in terms of our calendar, March the 12th of 515 B.C. So here we read in Ezra chapter 6 in verse 15, it says, "The temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar," and that was the 12th month of the year, "which was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius." So 39 days later, they were to keep the Passover. And they kept the Passover with a great deal of joy. Dropping down to verse 19. "And the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean. And they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for their brethren the priest, and for themselves. And then the children of Israel who had returned from the captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord God of Israel. And they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy. For the Lord made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel." So here we see the children of Israel allowed to come back into their land, allowed to rebuild the temple, rededicate it, and then they observe the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And they did so with a great deal of joy. They had been carried away in captivity because, quite frankly, justice did not rule in the land. They were perverting judgments. They were perverting God's truth. They were not seeking after God. And through a period of repentance over the time that they were in captivity, they finally come back and they do it right. They get their attitudes right. They sincerely and they humbly seek God and want to do His will. And so they celebrate the Passover and they celebrate the Days of Unleavened Bread with a great deal of joy and happiness. But how long did that last? You know, over a period of time, they became lax in terms of their relationship with God. And they drifted far from Him. And then when we come up to the time of the New Testament, at the Passover, or the last Passover that Jesus Christ had here on this earth, the attitude of the Jews at that time was very different than what we read described here in Ezra chapter 6. Approximately 547 years after this Passover, the Jews were preparing to observe another Passover with a very different attitude from what we see here in Ezra chapter 6. They unjustly killed the Messiah before observing the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread in 31 A.D. So today what I would like to do in the remainder of the sermon is consider the injustice that took place in Jerusalem in 31 A.D., looking at six hearings that Jesus Christ had to face before being subjected to His crucifixion. When you look at the gospel accounts, you see that Jesus Christ had to face six different hearings. Three of those hearings were religious, and three of those hearings were civil. The hearings, I'll just break them down to you in terms of the sixth. First of all, He had to appear before Annas. Then He had to appear before Caiaphas. And then He had to appear before the Sanhedrin. So those are the three religious hearings that He had to face before being put to death. But then after those religious hearings, He also had to face three civil hearings. He went before Pilate, then Pilate sent Him to Herod, and then Herod sent Him back to Pilate. So within a very short period of time, Christ had to face six unjust hearings before finally being put to death. And so today what I'd like to do is to review these with you so that the next time we find ourselves faced with a situation to where we say, that's not fair, that we can go to our high priest in heaven who faced a great deal of injustice in His life, and He will know exactly what we are going through, and He will give us the strength and the help that we need to face our trial the way that He had to face many prior to His death. So let's look at the first hearing that Jesus Christ was subjected to, His first appearance before Annas. John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12. John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12. So here we see the first hearing that He had to appear, and this particular hearing was before Annas. John chapter 18, beginning in verse 12, "Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus, and they bound Him." So here we see that Christ was arrested by a group of soldiers along with the Jewish religious leaders of His day. We are told that He is bound like a common criminal. This was not lawful. You could not bind an innocent man. The individual had to be formally charged or condemned as a criminal before he was able to be bound. And yet we see right off the bat that Jesus Christ is being treated in an unjust manner. And then continuing on in verse 13, "And they led Him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people." So Annas had been appointed high priest by Quirinius. He was the governor of Syria, and he was appointed in 6 AD. And he remained until he was deposed by Valerius Gratus, who was the governor or the procurator of Judea, in 15 AD. So in other words, Annas served as high priest for about 9 years. He was a very influential man. Annas had five sons and one grandson that served as high priest of the nation. So in some respects, he was like the godfather of the priestly family. He had a great deal of influence. And of course, that's why they took Jesus Christ to Annas first, because he was a very influential man. And so the current high priest was actually his son-in-law. So not only did he have five sons and a grandson that served as high priest, now we see that his son-in-law is the current high priest. And Caiaphas was the high priest from 18 to 36 A.D. So Annas was the patriarch of a very influential family of priests. You could almost sense his attitude toward Jesus Christ of, "Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to challenge the established society or the established rulership that we currently have in place? You know, I'm the power maker of this nation. Who do you think you are?" That was kind of Annas' attitude toward Jesus Christ. Then continuing on in verse 19 of John chapter 18, says, "The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. And Jesus answered him, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I have said.'" So when Annas began to examine Jesus Christ, Christ's attitude was, "Why are you asking me? You should ask those people who heard what I say." Why did he say that? Well, number one, Jesus had nothing to hide. He spoke openly before everyone. He spoke openly before the Jews. He spoke openly before those people who were at the temple. But then continuing on in verse 22, "And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, 'Do you answer the high priest like that?' And Jesus answered, 'If I have spoken evil, then bear witness of the evil. But if well, then why do you strike me?'" So here we see some of the injustice that Jesus Christ was confronted with prior to his death. Now I'd like to read you a short article from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia regarding this particular hearing that Jesus Christ was subjected to. It says, "The high priest, whether Annas or Caiaphas, proceeded to interrogate Jesus concerning his disciples and his doctrine. Such a proceeding formed no part of a regular Jewish trial, and was, moreover, not taken in good faith, but with a view of entrapping Jesus into admissions that might be used against him at the approaching trial before the council. It appears to have been in the nature of a private examination conducted probably while the members of the council were assembling. The dignified and appropriate answer of Jesus pointedly brought before the judge the irregularity he was committing, and was a reminder that his trial should begin with the examination of the witnesses." You see, the way legal proceedings were to follow is, you weren't supposed to take the individual that was charged with a crime and begin interrogating him. The hearing begins with interrogating the witnesses. What charge is being brought against this man? But that's not how it started. It started with the interrogation of Jesus Christ. And of course, then the article goes on to quote what Christ said here in John chapter 18, verses 20 and 21. "The reply to this was a blow from one of the officers, an outrageous proceeding which appears to have passed unrebuked by the judge, and it was left to Jesus himself to make the appropriate protest." So right off the bat, they're not following proper legal procedures in terms of the way that they are dealing with Jesus Christ. And yet, when he basically says, "Why are you asking me the questions? You're supposed to be asking the people that heard what I said," he was hit in the face. And then, of course, Christ's response was, "Well, look, if I've said something wrong, fine. But if I've said the truth, then why are you striking me in the face?" So here we see Jesus being struck by one of the officers of the high priest. You know, sometimes we can be so blinded by our actions. One of the officers struck Jesus because he thought Christ was being disrespectful toward the high priest. But in reality, it should have been the high priest that was struck, because he was not going about the legal proceedings in terms of how to try an individual that had been accused of committing a crime. Jesus didn't fight back. Jesus didn't become enraged. He simply remained meek and in control. Now, in a parallel account in Luke chapter 22, verses 52 and 53, Luke records the following. It says, "Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness.'" You see, Christ's arrest and trial was premeditated to occur under the cover of darkness. The religious leaders didn't want the general population to know what was taking place, because Christ was popular among the general populace. And so they didn't want the rest of the population to know that, well, we're doing something here that's a bit underhanded. It's hard to take if you know that you're being clandestinely mistreated. And I dare say that all of us have faced that from one time or another, haven't we? We probably always had to deal with an individual who has treated us quite rudely, but then when someone else is around, treats everybody else in a totally different way. They appear wonderful and charming and happy as long as there's a crowd around. But suddenly when there's nobody else around but you and that person and they treat you badly, that's very difficult to take, isn't it? And yet that's exactly the treatment that Jesus Christ was receiving. Christ died so that we can be released from the power of darkness. That's what the Apostle Paul wrote in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 13, which is far more powerful than most of mankind realizes. We live in a dark world, spiritually speaking, and most of mankind doesn't realize that at all. And yet Jesus Christ died so that this world eventually will be released from that power of darkness. You look at what is happening in the world today and the horrible things that are taking place. And the only answer that I can give you for the horrible, sad situation that we see in this world today is that there is a power of darkness at work. How can you explain somebody walking into a workplace or a school with a loaded gun and just start shooting people, and then ultimately turn the gun on themselves and kill themselves? The only explanation that I can give for that is there is an evil spirit at work that causes people to do such unexplainable things. So we've looked at the first hearing that Jesus Christ was faced with. That was with the former high priest, Annas. And now we come to the second hearing that he faces, and this time the current high priest, Caiaphas. Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, and we'll begin in verse 57. Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 57. Says, "And those who had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and he sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward, and they said, 'This fellow said that I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days.'" Now, from verse 56, we learn that all of the disciples forsook Jesus Christ. You know, talk about fair-weather friends. You know, when you're in a tight jam, when you're faced with a very difficult situation, the one comforting thing oftentimes that we can relate back to is the fact that we have family and friends that stand by our side. But here was Jesus Christ, faced with a horrible situation at the end of his life, and where were his friends? They all forsook him. They were fair-weather friends. But we know we would have done the same thing had we been there. Had we been faced with the same situation, we would have forsaken Christ just like his disciples did. This was a very unusual trial. They didn't know what charge to bring against him, so they tried to find false witnesses to accuse him of something. You know, how many times are people ever arrested, brought before a hearing, and they don't know what to charge the person with? So they have to go out and look for witnesses to try to bring some false accusation against an individual. Have you ever heard of a trial like that? And of course, no. You wouldn't get anywhere in today's legal system trying to do that. But that's exactly what occurred in the case of Jesus Christ. They arrested him. They brought him before the high priest for a hearing. But they didn't even know what to charge him with. And then when they tried to find false witnesses to accuse him of something, they couldn't find two that agreed. And so now they try to entrap Jesus with his own words. Now, where was Caiaphas coming from in doing what he did here? Notice John chapter 11. John chapter 11. What was the motivation of the high priest? After Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, we read the following here, beginning in verse 45 of John chapter 11. Then many of the Jews who came to Mary and had seen the things that Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. And then the high priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and they said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs." So here they're confronted with a threat toward their power. They are in charge. They are the leaders of the nation. And suddenly they see this individual that has more influence, more popularity than they do. Christ becomes a threat to their office and to their power. And so basically they call together a bunch of the leaders and say, "What do we do in a situation like this?" Then verse 48, "If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away our place and the nation." They were concerned about losing their influence. They were concerned about losing their office. They were concerned about losing their power. Why? Well, basically, the Jews had made certain agreements with the Roman government. They were afforded certain privileges provided they didn't rise against the Romans. So basically, the Roman government toward the Jews were, "Look, we'll let you handle your own internal affairs, provided you promise not to rebel against our authority and our government. You accommodate us and our rulership, and we'll accommodate you and your affairs, internal affairs that you are working on as a nation." And so the high priests and the elders and the Pharisees said, "Wait a minute. We could upset the apple cart here if we're not careful. It's better that one man die for the sake of the nation." Christ was a threat to them. Christ was a threat to the regular, normal, day-to-day affairs of the internal government of the Judean nation, and he had to be done away with. That's why they arrested him. That's why they already determined that they were going to kill him before they ever heard one charge against him. He had to go. A shift in power to Jesus Christ would upset the apple cart, and they feared an insurrection could occur. So the statement was probably a very thin veneer of a jealousy that they had toward Jesus Christ. He was a threat to their office. He was a threat to their power. And then continuing on in verse 49, "And then one of them, Caiaphas, being the high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not the whole nation should perish.' Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. And not only for that nation, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death." So it was from this point, shortly before the Passover, that the die had already been cast. They already determined this man must die so that he does not have more influence upon the nation. And so before they ever brought an accusation against him, before they ever decided what crime we're going to charge him with, we've already determined he's going to die. Now, how many of you would like to face a trial like that? You're arrested, you're brought before the court, and the court has already decided the end result. The end result is we're going to put you to death. This whole proceeding has nothing to do but with how can we legally do that. And that was what happened in the case of Jesus Christ. From that point forward, the Jewish leaders had already determined that he was going to be killed. You know, there's a very interesting thing here, however. You know, God used a high priest who was carnal, quite frankly, who was evil. God used that individual to prophesy the truth. And that's what he did in the case of Caiaphas. I'd like to read you once again a short article from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It says, the provisions relating to criminal trials, and especially to those in which the offense was punishable by death, were very stringent and were all framed in the interest of the accused. Among them were the following. The trial must begin by day, and if not completed before night, it must be adjourned and resumed the following day. The quorum of judges in capital cases was 23, that being the quorum of the Grand Council. A verdict of acquittal, which required only a majority of one, might be rendered on the same day as the trial was completed. In other words, if a person was determined to be innocent, then the trial could end there, and you only had to have a majority of one for that to occur. And other verdict could only be rendered on a subsequent day and required a majority of at least two. No prisoner could be convicted on his own evidence. It was the duty of a judge to see that the interests of the accused were fully protected. So whenever you had a legal procedure within the Jewish nation, it was the victim's, or it was the judge's responsibility to ensure that the individual that was accused of the crime was treated fairly. If the council decided he was innocent or he was acquitted, they only had to have a majority of one vote, and that ruling could be made on that day. But if the individual was determined to be guilty and deserving of death, then you had to have a majority of at least two votes. And that sentence could not be pronounced on that day. You had to wait at least until the following day to make that sentence. In other words, you got to sleep on it, to reconsider your vote before the individual was finally pronounced guilty. But in the case of Jesus Christ, that didn't occur, did it? In fact, within a very short period of time, he was arrested, he was convicted, and he was condemned. Look back at Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26. And let's pick up the trial here. Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 62. Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 62. And the high priest arose and he said unto him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now, stop and think about it for a moment. If you're in a legal proceeding, if you're being cross-examined, and you know the ulterior motives behind the individual that's cross-examining you, you know that you're innocent, you know that they are desirous to put you to death, and then when you're cross-examined, how tempting would it be to basically put somebody in their place, to tell them exactly what you thought of them? You know, for me, my blood would be boiling. It'd be very easy to give that individual a piece of my mind. But what was the reaction of Jesus Christ? He simply kept silent. He knew what was taking place. Obviously, he had debated many of these leaders before when they saw him in the temple healing someone on the Sabbath. He could easily put them in their place. But now, at a time of his trial, he kept silent. He didn't say anything. And then, of course, the high priest went on to say, well, tell us if you're the Christ, the Son of God. And then in verse 64, and Jesus said, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoke blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered and they said, he is deserving of death. As we just saw, they already decided the death penalty before they ever even arrested Jesus Christ. They knew what the outcome of the trial was going to be. They were simply looking for some reason to cry out, he's guilty and he's deserving of death. Jesus knew his words would be used against him if he said anything, so he simply remained quiet. And then they began to mistreat him, verse 67. And then they spat in his face, they beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one that struck you? Now Luke adds the following in Luke chapter 22, verses 63 through 65. It says, now the men who had held Jesus mocked him, and they beat him, and having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face, and they asked him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who struck you? And many other blasphemous things they spoke against him. So they charged Jesus Christ with the crime of blasphemy. And then they blindfolded him and they said, well, we'll see if you are the Christ or not. Who hit you this time? Who hit you this time? Basically an affront to him. And of course, as Luke records, it was blasphemy toward the Son of God. They were guilty of what they accused Jesus Christ of doing. Have you ever found yourself in a situation like that, where you are being accused of somebody for something that you know the person accusing you of is the one that is guilty of it? I have. And believe me, that is very hurtful and very difficult to take, and especially difficult to keep your mouth shut during that process. When you know somebody is looking at you, accusing you of something, and you're looking back at them, and in your mind you're going, you're the one that's guilty of that. That's hard to take. But Jesus Christ took it. He had all the power of the universe to use if he chose, but he sat there and he took it. He was beaten and he was ridiculed. And we should be reminded that Jesus Christ went through this for your sake and for mine. Now, this wasn't a part necessarily of his actual being put to death. This was the abuse that he had to face before that time. Why did he go through that? Well, there can be many answers and many reasons, but one of them is, as your high priest, when you're going through a situation like this in your life, and you get down on your knees and you cry out to him, he knows what you're going through. He's been there. He's done it. And of course, he understands what you're going through, and he can comfort you, and he can help you, and he can strengthen you during that time of need. Because unlike me and unlike you, Jesus Christ faced that situation, and he did it in a perfect example of how to deal with a situation such as that. Remember, we have a high priest that has endured far more than we will ever be asked to endure. So now we come to the third hearing, the hearing before the Sanhedrin. Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 1. Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 1. Now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders and the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him and they led him away, they delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Now Luke adds the following in Luke chapter 22, beginning in verse 66. Luke chapter 22, beginning in verse 66. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together, and they led him into their council, saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said unto them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me and let me go. So Christ knew what was going to take place. And when they were cross-examining him, he said, "Look, if I tell you the answer, you're not going to believe me. And if I ask you a question, you're not going to answer me." So basically he said, why should I answer your question? Because in the end, it's not going to matter what I say, because you're not going to let me go. He knew that the outcome had already been predetermined in their mind. Then in verse 69, he stated once again, "Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." And then they all said, "Are you the Son of God?" And he said unto them, "You rightly say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." The Sanhedrin was the council of the elders of the nation of Judea. It consisted of 70 men plus the high priest. So there was an odd number. In case there was ever a split decision, there would always be the odd number to break that decision. The Sanhedrin was composed of the high priest. It was composed of the current high priest, as well as all of the previous high priests that were still living, as well as members of the privileged families of the priestly families. It was composed of elders, in other words, tribal leaders, family heads. It was composed of scribes. These were the legal assessors. And then it was composed of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sanhedrin was the Jewish nation's official judicial body. Their council was the final court of appeal. You could not appeal anything higher than that. Once they made a decision, that decision was final and it could never be questioned. If the council found Jesus guilty, it was the last word, and it was representative of the nation finding him guilty. Much like in the United States, you know, we can go through the district court, we can go through the various federal courts, and we can finally go all the way up to the Supreme Court. And once they hear the case, they make the decision, then that's it. Well, the Sanhedrin was similar. They were the highest court of the land. But instead of being comprised of a few men or women, they were comprised of a group of 70. They met at daybreak because it was illegal for them to assemble before that time. The council could give a guilty verdict, but the Jews at that time were not allowed to impose the death penalty. They could say, "This man is guilty, this man is deserving of death," but then they could not carry out the death penalty. Any individual that was deserving of death had to appear before the Roman governor or the procurator in order for that death sentence to be carried out. And so the death sentence declared by the high priest was made legal by the Sanhedrin. And that's what we read here in Luke chapter 22. Now, once again, let me read you an article from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It said, "When Judea lost the last vestige of its independence and became a Roman province in 6 AD, the Sanhedrin ceased to have the right to inflict capital punishment or to administer the law of life and death. This jurisdiction was thenceforth transferred to the Roman procurator." In other words, he was the Roman governor. "The Sanhedrin submitted very reluctantly to this curtailment of its powers. A few years later, it exercised it illegally in a very riotous manner in the case of Stephen." Of course, that's found in Acts 7, verse 58. "Annas, however, of all men, had good reason not to violate this law, as his having done so during the absence of the procurator was the cause of him being deposed of the office of the high priest by Valerius Gratus in 15 AD. So they had a very strict protocol. The court could find someone guilty of death, but then in order to be able to carry out that death penalty, they had to take it to the Romans. And if they did not do so, then the high priest was held responsible, and as was the case with Annas, the high priest could be removed if he didn't follow that protocol. So here we have seen the three religious hearings that Jesus Christ was faced with. And now we go into the three civil hearings that Jesus Christ had to be faced with. It's interesting to consider that the Roman Empire controlled Judea in the first century. Pilate was the procurator. In other words, he was the governor of Judea. He was the representative, if you will, of the beast power in the first century in the nation of Judea. He was the Roman representative. And of course, the Roman government was viewed as the beast power. And so here was the representative of the beast power, and Jesus Christ had to appear before him. The representative of that beast power judged Jesus Christ innocent, while the rest of the nation pronounced the judgment of guilty against him. Let's go back to John chapter 18, and let's begin reading the account in verse 28. John chapter 18, beginning in verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might be able to eat the Passover. Pilate then went out to them, and he said, "Well, what accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said unto him, "If he were not an evildoer, would we not have delivered him up to you?" So that was a pretty interesting response by the Jewish people. Pilate says, "Well, what's this man guilty of?" And their response to Pilate was, "Well, if he wasn't guilty, do you think we would bring him to you?" They didn't want to have to say what they found him guilty of. And then they go on, verse 31. Then Pilate said unto them, "Will you take him and judge him according to your law?" And therefore the Jews said unto him, "It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Now stop and think about it for a moment. Here Pilate told them, "Look, you handle this. Don't bring him to me." And the Jews said, "Oh no, we can't do this. We're not allowed to put someone to death." Why would they say that? Why would they want Jesus Christ to be put to death by the Romans? You see, if they found him guilty and they put him to death, how would they put him to death? They would stone him. But you recall what John wrote here in John 18:32, that they did this signifying how Jesus would have to die. See, Jesus already pointed out that he would die by crucifixion, by being lifted up. And the Jews wanted Christ to be crucified as opposed to being stoned. Why did they want Christ put to death in that manner? You'll recall that Jesus Christ was a threat to their office. He was a threat to their power. And so they wanted him put to death in the most ignoble way possible. And that would be crucifixion. Because it was a stigma in the mind of a Jew for someone to be crucified. You see that in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. They wanted Christ to be crucified so that it would appear in the eyes of the people that he was under a curse by God. And so they wanted him to be put to death in that manner so that it would be implanted in the minds of the general population that this man is under a curse by God. In Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verses 22 and 23, we read the following. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. So they knew that if they could have him crucified, in the minds of the general population, they would view this man as, oh, he must be under a curse from God to be put to death in this manner. So Luke adds the following here in Luke chapter 23, verses 1 and 2. Luke chapter 23, verses 1 and 2. Concerning Christ and his trial with Pilate, Luke adds this. He says, then the whole multitude of them arose, and they led him to Pilate. So you could see that whole multitude. You got 70 individuals composing the Sanhedrin. And they lead him to Pilate. And then they began, verse 2, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king. What did they find Jesus Christ guilty of? Blasphemy. Did Jesus Christ ever tell the people that they weren't to pay taxes to Caesar? No. In fact, he said the opposite, didn't he? So this was a lie, a false accusation that they used against Christ in bringing him to Pilate. Christ said in Luke chapter 20 and verse 25, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God." The Jews had accused Christ of blasphemy. And now when they bring him before Pilate, they're accusing him of a totally different crime. Now back to John's account. Let's continue in verse 33 of John chapter 18. John chapter 18, verse 33. "Then Pilate entered the praetorium again, and they called Jesus and said unto him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And Jesus answered him, 'Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?' Pilate answered, 'Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priest have delivered you to me. What have you done?' And Jesus answered, 'My kingdom is not of this world, and if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here.' Then Pilate therefore said unto him, 'Are you a king then?' And Jesus answered, 'You say rightly that I am a king, and for this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth hears my voice.' And Pilate said unto him, 'Well, what is truth?' And when he had said this, he went out to the Jews, and he said unto them, 'I find no fault at all.'" So here essentially is an acquittal. They bring Jesus Christ to Pilate. He's the Roman governor. It's his responsibility to pronounce sentence upon him, whether he be put to death or not. Pilate cross-examines him. He walks out and said, "He's an innocent man. I don't find any fault with this man." He was looking for a way out. You almost get the impression that Pilate knew that Jesus Christ was innocent, and he didn't want to have anything to do with this, and he was looking for a way somehow to deflect this somewhere else. And so then he gets the brilliant idea. "You said he was a Galilean, didn't you? And Herod happens to be in the city at this time, so I'm going to send him to Herod, who was the ruler of Perea and Galilee at the time. And I'll let Herod deal with him." So that brings us to the fifth hearing that Jesus Christ was subjected to, his appearance before Herod. And we find this in Luke chapter 23, beginning in verse 6. Luke chapter 23, beginning in verse 6. "When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes, they stood and they vehemently accused him." I mean, you can almost see this mob scene. They're taking him to Herod, and all these men are gathered around, and they're probably shouting all kinds of accusations about Jesus Christ and what he is guilty of. "And then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt. And he mocked him, and he arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and he sent him back to Pilate. And that very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with one another." So here you have Herod Antipas. He was the tetrarch, or he was the governor of a fourth part of the country. He was the ruler of Galilee and Perea, and he was very interested in seeing Jesus. Why was he so interested in seeing Jesus? Who did Herod have put to death? John the Baptist. And then after the death of John the Baptist, he heard about Jesus Christ and the miracles that Jesus Christ was performing. And what was Herod's response? It's John the Baptist coming back to life. We see that in Matthew chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. Earlier, Herod had stated here in Matthew chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, said, "At that time Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus, and he said unto his servants, Well, this is John the Baptist. He's risen from the dead. And therefore, these powers are at work in him. So Herod wanted to see Jesus Christ perform a miracle. He was very curious about Jesus Christ and who he was, and he was offended that Christ would not perform a miracle in front of him. So Herod and his soldiers mocked Christ, but they found no fault with him, and therefore they sent him back to Pilate. It's interesting. Two enemies became friends over the mistreatment of Jesus Christ. You know, here were two, if you will, individuals who represented horrible rulership. And through the mistreatment of Jesus Christ, they actually became friends. If you know, and of course Jesus Christ knew that he was going to be put to death, if you knew that you were going to die, and you were standing before an individual that was responsible for killing your cousin, John the Baptist, what would you do or say? You knew that you're doomed. Your fate is already sealed. And here you're standing before a guy who was responsible for killing undoubtedly somebody that you loved and had a lot of respect for, John the Baptist. What would you do? What would you say? You know, undoubtedly, Jesus Christ knew what was going to happen to Herod Antipas. He knew that in a few short years, Herod was going to be summoned to Rome because he had been in a fight constantly with the ruler of Syria. And he knew it was just a matter of time till his days were numbered. He was going to be summoned to Rome. He was going to be removed of his leadership and his rulership. He was going to lose all of his money, and he was going to die in exile. Undoubtedly, Christ knew what was going to happen. He can declare the end from the beginning in that sense. He knew based upon the attitudes and the actions where all this was going to lead. And that's what happened to Herod. And Christ was standing before him. Undoubtedly, he was being verbally abused. He knew exactly that this man was responsible for the death of his cousin. And what did he do? What would you have done? I know what I would have done. And it wouldn't have been very converted. But here was Christ, and he simply said nothing. He didn't do anything that would border on the line of a sin. So Christ said nothing and simply took the abuse. So now we come back to the sixth and final hearing that he is subjected to, this time, once again, the second time before Pilate. So let's go back to John chapter 18, and let's pick up the story. John chapter 18. Beginning in verse 39. And here Pilate is speaking. He says, "But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews?" And then they all cried out, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. So here Christ was an innocent man. They knew that he was innocent, but they had already determined he was going to die because he was a threat to their office and to their power. And so Pilate said, "Look, you know, we have a tradition. Every year at the Passover, I release a prisoner to you. Shall I release you, your king?" And of course, their response is, "No, but Barabbas." And of course, they refer to Barabbas being a robber or a criminal. Pilate wanted to release Christ because he knew that he was innocent. In a side account in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 19, Matthew records the following. "While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, 'Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him.'" See, Pilate knew that he was innocent. He even had his wife send a message saying, "Look, don't have anything to do with this. This is wrong with what is happening to him." Then continuing on in verse 1 of John 19. "So then Pilate took Jesus and he scourged him, and the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head and put on him a purple robe. And then he said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands. And Pilate went out again and said unto him, 'Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him.' And then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to him, 'Behold the man.'" You know, undoubtedly, Pilate was hoping that the Jews might be satisfied, seeing that Jesus had already been mistreated. He had already been abused. He had been scourged. And perhaps his hope was that in bringing him out and they see him, that they would take pity on him and say, okay, enough is enough. But that was not toward that individual. And we say, okay, enough's enough. This is enough. But that was not the attitude of the Jews at that time. Verse 6 of John chapter 19, they demanded his death. Therefore the chief priests and the officers say unto him, they cried out, crucify him, crucify him. And Pilate said unto him, will you take him and crucify him, because I find no fault in him. It's interesting. Here Pilate, once again, he was the representative of the beast power. He interrogates him, takes him out, and said, this is an innocent man. I don't find any fault in him. But of course, the leaders of the Jewish people at that time had a totally different story. Notice what they said, verses 7 and 8. And Jesus answered, and the Jews answered, we have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was even more afraid. So now, after hearing this, he's even more convinced that Christ is innocent and he shouldn't have anything to do with this. And then verse 9, went in again into the praetorium, and he said unto Jesus, well, where are you from? And Jesus gave him no answer. And then Pilate said unto him, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? And Jesus answered and he said, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given unto you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. So basically, Christ was telling Pilate, look, you can't do anything to me unless that power had been given to you from above. But those people who delivered me into your hands, they will bear responsibility for this. They have the greater sin. And then Pilate, verse 12, from then on Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend, and whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. And when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out, sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, and in Hebrew, Gabbatha. And that was the preparation day of the Passover in about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. Now, Matthew adds the following in Matthew chapter 27 and beginning in verse 24. Matthew 27 verses 24 and 25 says, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water. He washed his hands before the multitude saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. So Pilate knew that here was an innocent man that was being put to death. And he washed his hands of it and says, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And then notice what the people said in verse 25 of Matthew chapter 27. Then all the people answered and they said, his blood be upon us and our children. Can you imagine the hatred of someone that would actually say that? Pilate says, look, I'm innocent of this man, just man's blood. And they said, let his blood be upon us and our children. They hated Christ so bad, they despised him so much, that they were willing to make that statement. No rational person would say, let this man's blood be upon us then. No rational person would say that. But a person that was motivated by hatred and vengeance, that individual has the mindset that would make such a statement. Verse 19, going back now to John chapter 19, beginning in verse 15. John chapter 19, beginning in verse 15. They cried out and they said, away with him, away with him, crucify him. And Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And then they delivered him to them to be crucified, and then they took Jesus and they led him away. So here you have the leader of a very powerful nation, Rome, being intertwined in, quite frankly, a misjudgment of the law. And unfortunately, Pilate acquiesced to the mob mentality, and he became a guilty party to the death of Jesus Christ. You know, in the six hearings that we have looked at that Jesus Christ was subjected to, we've seen jealousy, we've seen hatred, we've seen conspiracy, we've seen lies, we've seen injustice, and we have seen abuse. Sins that the world that we live in today is full of. Christ endured all of this prior to his crucifixion. This year, as we prepare for the Passover, let's remember the terrible injustice that Jesus Christ had to endure for your sake and for mine. And the next time we feel like complaining, that's not fair, and then we try to do something about it, let's remember the admonition of the Apostle Peter. Turn, if you will, to 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 20. In conclusion, let's look here at one final section of Scripture as we consider the horrible injustice that Jesus Christ was subjected to, and a point that we can take from this. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 20. Here Peter writes, he says, and let's put this into perspective as well. You know, where was Peter when Jesus Christ was going through all of this? He forsook him, didn't he? And then when the servant girl came out and said, "This is one of his disciples," what did Peter do? He denied knowing Jesus Christ. So with that in mind, as we read here 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 20, he says, "For what credit is it when we are beaten for our faults and you take it patiently?" In other words, when we've done something wrong and we get punished for that wrongdoing and we take it patiently, so what? You know, you got what was coming to you. But, he says, "But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God." You know, when we're striving to do what is right, when we are obeying God, and then we end up being mistreated for that, and we patiently take it, Peter says, you know, God takes note of that. Then he goes on to add here, continuing in verse 21, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. And when he suffered, he did not threaten, but he committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed." The next time you find yourself in a situation and you're about to say, "That's not fair," reflect upon the perfect example that Jesus Christ left for you and me.